From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
President Trump has threatened fire and fury if the North Koreans don't stop threatening us. So in response, the North Koreans threatened to attack Guam. Is the president going to tweet his way into a war? Two experts will join us to discuss Kim Jong-un's options and ours. The FBI raided Paul Manafort's house last month in a significant escalation of the Russia investigation. Maybe that's why the president suddenly got so mad at the acting FBI director. Juliette Kayyem will tell us what she thinks the raid means. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow. Later in the show, my favorite editor at Breitbart, John Carney, will join us to discuss the other person that has Trump mad on Twitter this week. That's Mitch McConnell. Is he who's stopping Trump from draining the swamp? Plus, the software engineer who wrote a controversial memo at Google is out and looking for a new job. We'll discuss why up ahead. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor of Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. We'll be getting to the feud between President Trump and Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, to the FBI raid on Paul Manafort's house, and to that memo on diversity that's caused all sorts of drama at Google. But obviously the thing that's been keeping some of us up at night this week is North Korea, so let's start there. President Trump has continued to ratchet up his war of words with Kim Jong-un. On Friday morning, he tweeted that military responses to North Korea are locked and loaded, but that hopefully Kim won't make it necessary for him to use them. Here he is earlier in the week after North Korea had threatened to attack at or near Guam.
If North Korea does anything in terms of even thinking about attack of anybody that we love or we represent or our allies or us, they can be very, very nervous. I'll tell you what, and they should be very nervous because things will happen to them like they never thought possible.
By the way, I want to give a shout out to our listeners on Public Radio Guam. We air in Guam at noon Saturdays on KPRG FM 89.3. So, Katrina, how are you feeling this week?
There's the bluster and bombast that's so scary, Josh. I mean, Donald Trump's talking like a promoter of a world wrestling match, not the president of the United States. Now, we know there are more sober-minded people in the room, but this bluster and bombast could feed miscalculation. Could feed a downward spiral of brinkmanship. There's always that danger. So I come back, it's imperative that there be ratcheting down of tensions, that there's dialogue, not escalation. There is no military option on the table that will work. Effective diplomacy, tough diplomacy over these last years, until it has worked. It has constrained the nuclear program of North Korea. So I think sober minds need to come to bear. And I think it's worth remembering the history. We live in an eternal present often in the media, but effective diplomacy constrained the programs in North Korea. 1994 froze North Korea's plutonium program. There was a moratorium on a missile test began in 1998. But George W., John Bolton, Dick Cheney, they preferred regime change, which is, you know, has redoubled the commitment of a country, rogue nation like North Korea, to acquire nuclear weapons. So I step back, sober minds in the room, tough diplomacy, regional partners are going to be needed, not this bluster and bombast, which is obviously aimed at, his base, but it's not going to be aimed at a base if there's, you know, any accidental nuclear miscalculation.
Rich, I feel like there's been sort of divided reaction even among hawks in the Republican Party. Marco Rubio has been in support of the president's comments, saying that they're appropriately strong, whereas John McCain has been critical. He's concerned that Donald Trump is making threats that he's not going to be prepared to deliver on if the North Koreans push him. What do you make of the strategy that the president has taken this week, or is it even a strategy?
Well, I have a lot of sympathy with the distaste and disregard he has for the establishment view on North Korea, which hasn't delivered a lot of results over the last 25 years. It's been a bipartisan failure of the foreign policy establishment. But his statement, I think, was a mistake. One, if you're going to draw a red line, it should be clear what the red line is. And it wasn't clear whether he meant that if North Korea just continued to make verbal threats, that was a red line, or whether if it continued to develop this capacity to put a nuclear weapon atop an ICBM that could reach the United States, that was the red line. So it was imprecise and it was blustery and it was confusing because you had Trump, who was bellicose, you had Secretary of Defense Mattis, who was firm, And you had Secretary of State Tillerson, who was basically very conventional and mouthing the same Foreign Service talking points on this, which is that North Korea is not our enemy, that we want to sit down with the North Koreans and talk and work towards the goal of denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula, which is a complete fantasy. And I think we just have to admit that North Korea is a nuclear power. It's not going to stop being a nuclear power. There's no way we're going to talk the North Koreans out of that goal. It's a very important, even existential goal for them. They believe it ensures the survival of the regime, and then proceed with what I would think be a more realistic strategy of pursuing in the long term regime change rather than a negotiated solution that doesn't exist, and in the short term have a policy that it works in effect as a very robust containment and deterrence policy.
We're going to go in a little bit of a different order than usual this week. Normally, we have our special panels at the end of the show, but we wanted to bring in a couple of experts right now to help Katrina and Rich and me make sense of the situation. Evelyn Farkas is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and she was a deputy assistant secretary of defense in the Obama administration. And Tom Nichols is a professor of national security affairs at the Naval War College. Tom, you've been making a sort of don't panic case this week, saying that this week isn't really any scarier than last week. What are people missing when they're freaking out about this?
First, it's important for me to say that I don't represent the views of the government on this. It's my own personal view. I think there's almost a kind of Cuban Missile Crisis envy where people want to believe that we're in this sort of 13-day loop where everything has to get decided in the next 48 or 72 or 96 hours, or somehow we're at war. And we're not under an imminent threat. That threat is coming. There's no doubt about it. The North Koreans have solved, or at least seem to have solved, both ends of the ICBM problem, which is the miniaturized warhead and a delivery vehicle that's long enough, that has enough power to reach the United States. But that, you know, I think Tillerson has a good point here. I mean, this is not something that's going to happen tomorrow. We're not even in the run-up to the operational North Korean ICBM. And I think that there's still time to talk. Now, I totally agree with Rich that you're not going to denuclearize North Korea. I mean, we've been living with North Korea for over a decade now as a nuclear power. On the other hand, I disagree with Katrina that what we've been doing has been working. I mean, if things that we've been doing since 1994 have been working, then we wouldn't be in the situation we're in today. But there's nothing imminent. I mean, part of the notion of a crisis is that you have a clock running with a huge amount of threat imminent within, you know, days, maybe weeks. And I think that actually it's almost the Americans now who are determined to kind of push this clock so that it runs like a crisis. And I don't see any point in doing that, at least not yet. When they get closer to an operational long-range nuclear weapon, then, you know, we're going to have to think about things differently. But I don't see that we're in that now, and I don't think there's any point in acting as if we are.
Evelyn, as the president tweets about this, how does it affect that clock? Because, I mean, North Korea has made bombastic, outlandish statements about what they're going to do for a very long time. It's not usually met with sort of similar statements from the United States. Do you see risk that that can escalate into something that's bigger than a war of words?
Yes, and I would agree with Tom. This is a completely manufactured crisis, you know, in quotation marks. Nothing has changed materially, you know, this week as opposed to last week. The North Koreans still don't have the capability to actually launch a nuclear ICBM at the United States mainland, have it successfully land on a target. Of course, they are closer, and that's cause for concern. But again, this is no different from where we were a week or a month ago with North Korea. And I think we've done a good job deterring North Korea militarily over the years. We have, as others just mentioned, not done a good job keeping them from building a nuclear program, a plutonium and then a uranium-based nuclear program, which then, of course, has been accompanied by their missile program. So we need to do some new thinking here. I have some ideas on that front. But certainly, getting to your question, I mean, the president's rhetoric has been really unseemly. It's the rhetoric of the weakling. It's the rhetoric that we normally hear coming out of Pyongyang, not out of Washington. So, and all it's done is really just ratchet up concern and create, you know, frankly speaking, a bit of a media frenzy here in the United States and elsewhere.
I think both Evelyn and Tom mentioned that diplomacy had not worked. But, I mean, you have someone like William Perry, who was Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration, and others, Gallucci, who'd worked on these talks. There was a diplomatic effort aimed at a long-term resolution of the North Korean nuclear dilemma. And working with allies in South Korea, Japan, there was a bargain on offer. Normalization of relations with North Korea in exchange for giving up its quest for nuclear weapons. Tantalizingly close to an agreement, President George W. abandoned Clinton's diplomatic plan for his more confrontational model and, in many people's judgment, lost an opportunity. It's not to say we are not in a bad place today, but there was a history of talks of tough diplomacy. The idea that Rich laid by suggested of regime change, that has been on offer. And as I said earlier, it simply has led to the doubling down of a rogue regime like North Korea to acquire nuclear weapons. When you look out at what happened to Libya, to Gaddafi, this leader is reckless, evil.
If I could,
but he's rational in the sense of acquiring nuclear weapons as a deterrent against being invaded.
Right, and he's done that in the course of negotiations. The negotiations are just a tool of the regime to delay
the
and win some concessions while they...
I was on the Hill during all this. I went over to North Korea in 2008. Mm-hmm. You're both right, and you're both getting a little bit wrong. All the administrations, let's go back, we can go to Clinton with the agreed framework. They employed a combination of deterrence and diplomacy. It broke down under the Bush administration, but frankly speaking, the cheating was ongoing towards the end of the Clinton administration. But the Clinton administration tried very hard to keep things on track. When the Bush people came in, I think they made a miscalculation in how they confronted North Korea. And unfortunately, we weren't able to keep North Korea at the table. I was working on the other side of the aisle, but I saw this up close. We didn't like the fact that the Bush administration sort of let the situation slip out of control. Nevertheless, the North Koreans obviously were hell-bent on doing what they were doing with their nuclear program. Then the Bush administration came in and did something very effective. They had a very effective sanctions regime. Sort of the shorthand for them was called the Banco Delta Asia sanctions, mainly because Chinese banks were forced to play along with us in those sanctions. It got the North Koreans back to the negotiating table, and that's when, during that time period, I went to Pyongyang in 2008, went to the nuclear facilities. We were on track with the North Koreans, but unfortunately, we took the pedal off on the sanctions front. So I think what we've learned from all of this, whether it's Republicans or Democrats, is that we need a multi-pronged strategy. We can't just put pressure on and then take it off when the North Koreans come to the negotiating table. We've got to maintain pressure on the North Koreans and, you know, have a combination of conventional and nuclear deterrence, pressure primarily from sanctions, diplomacy, where we say very clearly what our objectives are, and I don't think we should talk about regime change because we need China and Russia with us. And then finally, I think there's a tantalizing thing that we can try with this new young leader, which is to work with China to work on some internal reform, which may ultimately get to some kind of regime change because North Korea can change internally if they have some economic reform. Now, we'll have to hold our noses based on what I'm outlining here, because I'm not advocating for regime change, and this is a despicable regime.
I need to take a quick break. We'll be back shortly with this whole crew to continue talking about North Korea. Meanwhile, let us know what you think on our Facebook page or message us on Twitter. That's at LRCKCRW. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the left is Katrina VandenHeuvel of The Nation magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. And we are also joined by two experts on North Korea, Evelyn Farkas of the Atlantic Council and Tom Nichols, professor at the Naval War College. So, Tom, I want to ask you about something that Katrina said earlier and that Evelyn was talking about. Basically, Katrina's contention that Kim Jong-un is a rational actor, and then Evelyn sort of laying out a way to apply a variety of pressures to try to make it in his rational interest not to make too much trouble. Do you think that framework is correct? And even though people sort of talk about him as being this kind of crazy dude, that we can basically look at the incentives he faces and then just try to put the incentives in front of him so that this problem doesn't spiral out of control?
I think there's no more abused term when talking about deterrence and international relations than the rational actor, because we have a tendency to say that rational means someone who is like us and who thinks the way we do and is a fundamentally reasonable person. Rational just means that people have preferences, they act on them in an organized way, they don't do things randomly, they don't like vanilla ice cream one day and then chocolate the next for no reason, that they have some sort of set of goals that they are acting on. So in that sense, sure, in some very large sense, Kim's rational. But I think to go back to a point Evelyn, I think, was making very well before the break, this notion that you can reach out to the rational side of the Kim family, because it's not just this guy. This has been going on for three generations. I think the reason negotiations have always been difficult with them is because that their premise and our premise are not the same. Our premise is to denuclearize them, bring them into an international nuclear regime where they abandon this quest. Their premise is to stretch this out as long as they can, squeeze as much possible concession out of it, and then go for nuclear weapons anyway. The thing that's really undermined our ability to deal with the North Korean nuclear program, and this is where Kim, I think, makes a very hard-headed, and his marshals, by the way, who are all, 150 years old, they make a very hard-headed calculation that they have an ace in the hole that we keep forgetting about, which is the placement of Seoul, South Korea, as a constant hostage to any thought of Western military action. That no matter what we do, they can point to Seoul and say, you can retaliate against us, you can engage in preventive strikes against us, but we will destroy Seoul as part of that bargain. And I think that's even more important as a bargaining chip for them than some of the other things that we've been talking about. But they have been, as Evelyn put it, they've been hell-bent on doing this for decades. And the notion that we are somehow going to talk them out of it because they can rationally understand that, I think is foolish. I think the thing we could do is to say, look, we understand your primary goal is to keep North Korea an independent state and to keep the Kim family in charge of North Korea. And we can agree with you. This is kind of like the, not invading Cuba promise. We can agree with you to leave that alone and to not talk about forcible regime change if you freeze this missile program. Because I think that's the thing that now the nuclear weapons part is out of the barn. The missile program, I think, is something where we could freeze more testing, get the Chinese on. Because the other thing is the status quo suits the Chinese. And I think the Chinese don't want the North Koreans doing anything more than they're doing. They want a buffer state right where it is. They don't want a unified pro-American Korea on their border. And I think that there's still a lot of room to kind of freeze things where they are, not necessarily to go backward, but to make sure that things don't get any worse, at least in the short term. But in the end, we're always kind of kicking this can down the road. It's important to remember that for all the talk we just did about George Bush, I mean, Bill Clinton was pretty mad at Jimmy Carter for getting involved in this situation and short-sheeting him at the last minute. Every administration that's tried to do this has come up frustrated because of the location of North Korea, because of the location of Seoul, because of the amount of, going all the way back to Nixon. Nixon looked for options against North Korea and had to abandon them in 1969. So this is not a new problem, and we're not going to solve it overnight by, tweeting blustery threats. This is going to take more diplomacy.
This week being comparable to the Syrian, the strike against the Syrian airfield after the regime's use of chemical weapons, where a lot of people thought, wow, this is a major strategic departure. There may be an entirely new approach to Syria that's opening up here that Trump has catalyzed. And no, he really adopted just basically the status quo policy in Syria that was a direct borrow from the Obama administration. And again, yep. Here you listen to his words and the bluster, and you're like, whoa, he's totally rethinking things in North Korea. I think the chances are much more likely we end up in negotiations rather than in military conflict, because I don't think there's any indication that they have a strategy or have thought through a new strategy. And I think that North Koreans, though, have a very strong strategic sense of what they want to do. I think they want to make a colorable case that they have this capacity now, and they're very close to put a nuclear weapon atop an ICBM. And they're going to say, hey, we're open for business. Come and talk to us and cut another deal and kick the can down the road again.
I have a darker view. I mean, listen, Donald Trump, a single nuclear blast could unleash inconceivable death and destruction. As quickly as he could post a tweet, Trump has the power, the unilateral authority. Trump could destroy human civilization. This is a moment, it seems to me, where it's bipartisan, but leaders from both parties should communicate to the White House that the president mustn't launch a nuclear first strike without congressional authorization. It's time to reform U.S. nuclear weapons policy. U.S. should take its nuclear weapons off of hair trigger status, declare a policy of no first use of nuclear weapons, and prohibit this or any president from unilaterally launching a nuclear attack. Work with military and congressional leaders. I think launching a nuclear attack is a decision so momentous for all of civilization that it should have the kinds of checks and balances on executive powers called for by our Constitution. And I know this will not happen, but it's a discussion that needs to happen, and the moment we're in demands it.
Evelyn, what do you see as the military options that exist here? The president sent this tweet saying that the military options are locked and loaded, but then, you know, the president has also tweeted that he has a tax reform plan ready to go and other things like that. And so I don't assume that to be the case, but can we assume that the North Koreans assume
of James Comey and lots of other things he's asserted over the last several months. Look, I don't think there are any good military options. I'm sure he's asked for military options. I'm sure there's a military option to probably shoot at those ships that were reported being loaded with weapons. You can imagine certain scenarios, but I wouldn't even want to try detailing them because anything that we do will be met with a North Korean response, not aimed at us, of course, because they can't afford to really pick on the big dog, but they will, as Tom indicated earlier, they'll strike out at Seoul, or at South Korea, not necessarily at the capital, because that I think they also will realize will be escalatory. But the North Koreans will respond with another use of force, with their own use of force against our allies if we use force against them. And I just don't understand. I mean, it's not in our interest to use force against North Korea. This problem is entirely containable. You know, we have the tools at our disposal to contain North Korea. And then over time, we can see whether we need to do more. But I would argue that, unfortunately, the best compromise, the best deal we can make is to say to the North Koreans, as well as the Russians and the Chinese, we're not going to try for regime change. We're going to tolerate this horrible regime. In exchange, they are going to eliminate the threat that they pose right now to international peace and security and to the United States and its allies.
We're going to leave it there on North Korea. I want to thank Evelyn Farkas, the Atlantic Council, and Tom Nichols from the Naval War College for joining us. Let us know what you think about increasing tensions with North Korea on our Facebook page or message us on Twitter. That's at LRCKCRW. Meanwhile, we are going to turn and talk about developments in the Russia investigation. And for that, we are now joined by Juliette Kayyem. She's faculty chair of the Homeland Security Program at the Harvard Kennedy School and a former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security. So let's talk about this raid on Paul Manafort's home. It seems to be in the style books. When the FBI does an early morning raid, you describe it in the newspaper as a pre-dawn raid. And that's what happened to Manafort, looking for documents as part of Robert Mueller's investigations that stem from Russian interference in the 2016 election. Juliette, are you surprised by this raid? And what do you think it tells us about where the investigation is?
I am surprised by this raid, because normally in an investigation like this, there would have had to have been some evidence that he was either hiding evidence. Someone would have had told the FBI and Mueller's team that Manafort was hiding evidence or likely to destroy evidence that was actually in his home rather than what I would assume are multiple offices. And that Mueller's team would have had to have proved it to a court, right, to be able to get the warrant that allowed them into the house. So there's a lot of juicy stuff out there that we're not seeing right now that would have allowed this raid to occur. And it then, you know, the fact that the raid occurred several weeks ago at about the same time or seems to have triggered Donald Trump's attacks on the Mueller team and Sessions suggests that all eyes are on Manafort now, much like they were on former National Security Advisor Flynn a couple months ago. And so just a couple takeaways from this, just from where we are, because we know that this is moving every single day. We wake up this morning to learn, at least by some news reports, that Donald Trump's long-term sort of secretary/assistant, Ronna Graff, is that the investigators are hoping to interview her. I think the first thing just is that we tend to bifurcate the investigation and think, oh, it's either about financial stuff or about collusion between the Trump team and the Russians to help win the election. It is possible it is both. And I think it's just a weird way to look at it and say, oh, well, this is just financial, you know, misgivings or misdoings. And having nothing to do with the election. The reason why, presumably, the Russians wanted Donald Trump to win, whether Donald Trump's team colluded or not, whether Don Jr. knew what he was doing in that meeting or not, would have been to protect the very investments that they have with the Trump family, or to, of course, end the sanctions which are hurting their people. So this bifurcation that you see in the media, I think, is really misleading. It could be that the election and the financial dealings are actually quite connected. And the second thing is just a race right now. I think Donald Trump realizes, in fact, his silence the last couple of days related to this investigation. He seems to now be doing the talking points, so to speak, and not going after Mueller anymore, is that this is too far gone for a firing of Mueller to mean anything but that Donald Trump is very guilty. You know, you do have grand juries convened. You do have these raids going on. You probably have, more likely than not, a fight for maybe immunity between Paul Manafort and Mike Flynn, who gets it and whether they have anything to deliver. So you have too much going on to simply say that it's a fishing expedition. And I suspect in the next couple months, we will wake up one morning with indictments, and most of us will have only a small hint of what's in them.
When you say one morning, do you think that could come soon? Or are we still looking, you know, months and months out from now?
Well, I think still months and months out, although, you know, a couple things that I'm looking at and just, you know, and we're all reading tea leaves here fairly, and I'm pretty careful about saying I know what the theory of the case is. I think it could be all the above, but I definitely don't think there's proof of collusion yet, or at least what we've seen publicly. I think the fact that the people that Mueller wants to interview are getting closer and closer to Trump suggests that this thing is picking up pace very, very fast. Where I think the race is between Mueller and an indictment, which I would, you know, I'm looking at sort of late September, early October, and a potential sort of preemptive pardon by Donald Trump for those who he feels that he should pardon now. He's allowed to do that by law, even before indictments are sent. So I'm looking at the next 6 weeks as being really historic in nature and just sort of hold on. I mean, I think, you know, I think I'm humble enough to know I only know a little bit of what's going on in Mueller's investigation, but I certainly know who he's hired. And I certainly know that when you do a morning raid against the former campaign manager, that you can't simply dismiss that as he was a part-time employee who Trump hasn't spoken to in a couple months.
Rich, what do you make of what Juliet sketches out there about the timing and when Trump is and isn't engaged with this? We saw this sort of at the time puzzling attack from Trump on the acting FBI director, Andrew McCabe, who Trump could replace if he was so bothered by Andrew McCabe. And it was like, why is Trump going after today? And then it turned out to line up with this Manafort raid. But as the president gets more distracted with North Korea, with his fight with Mitch McConnell, what do you agree with Juliet that that's sort of a signal that he thinks the probe is too far gone for him to try to stop anymore?
I don't know. I don't think anyone knows. I'm not sure Donald Trump knows. I think this is a very volatile situation. I think Michael Flynn and Paul Manafort are obviously in extreme legal jeopardy. What we know about Michael Flynn's vulnerabilities, though, seems a little removed from the so-called Russia scandal, since the foreign money and foreign dealings there seem to overwhelmingly have to do with Turkey. Manafort, though, his financial dealings much more directly impinge on the question of Russia collusion, because he did a lot of shady business in that part of the world. And this search warrant is very suggestive, because the usual practice is a prosecutor uses the least obtrusive means possible to obtain information, and a pre-dawn raid of this sort is usually used against, you know, a hardened criminal or someone who's not cooperating with the legal process, not someone like Paul Manafort, who's hired a lawyer and volunteered to testify, testified before a congressional committee, and et cetera. So it suggests that Mueller is serious as a heart attack, and Manafort and Flynn are in a lot of trouble. What it means more broadly, and is he going to be as aggressive seeking business records from Jared Kushner or from Trump himself? I don't think we know. But if I were Trump, I think it makes no sense to fire Mueller unless you believe that there is a high-caliber smoking gun that will irreparably harm your presidency. So you just take the risk and try to outrun the law, even though there's really no way to shut down the investigation one way or the other. But with Trump, there's always also the irrational option that he's just so offended by this and so offended by the idea of himself or his family members being caught up in this investigation that he thinks is unfair and ultimately spawned by people who couldn't accept the fact that he won the election, he might do it anyway. Even though I think that the rational thing is, as Julia is suggesting, he has the pardon power he can use preemptively. He has all these means of scandal defense, if it comes to that, that have been used in the past, you know, arguing it's old news, arguing whatever the offenses are removed from what the initial scandal was supposed to be. All that's still available to him. And I think just if he's rationally calculating his interest, assuming there's not a smoking gun, he would just wait and see what happens and then figure out how to litigate and fight it politically.
Katrina, what's your forecast?
You know, my sense is Manafort is part of this lobbying industrial complex. When you think of draining the swamp in Washington, you want to drain people like Mr. Manafort, pretty odious person. But FBI pre-dawn raids, I mean, sort of silver screen or dark silver screen. FBI has a history of sort of abusive strong-arm tactics. It seems like they want to flip Manafort into cooperating. Build a case against him. And the warrant, which they did get, suggests that Mueller's team doesn't think Manafort was actually complying or giving all that he had. And as Juliet noted, I mean, that warrant demanded tax and foreign banking records. So you're looking likely at criminal charges related to the Federal Bank Secrecy Act, which requires Americans to report their foreign banking accounts. You know, Manafort, as I said, he's one of many of these people, these kinds of lobbyists who've worked for shady, abusive foreign governments, whether it's Ukraine or Central African governments. And so, it ties into potential collusion, the Russia investigation. But I think an FBI raid pre-dawn is not in the best of the American tradition. Use warrants to get Manafort into court. He was complying with committees and enforce that. But clearly, this is going to hang over the Trump administration, preemptive pardons as discussed likely, and the fight between Flynn and Manafort, who will get them, yes. And will it extend out to the Kushners? As Juliet noted, longtime assistant secretary to Trump now being brought in. So it's hard to know when this is really going to wrap up. I think September, October for one of the first indictments maybe, but Mueller's team is aggressive and has a lot of financial people ready to do their work.
You've been listening to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, and I've been talking with Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation, Rich Lowry of National Review, and Juliet Kayyem. She's a former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security and the host of the podcast, The Skiff. We'll be right back.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. We're now going to turn and talk about the burgeoning feud between President Trump and Mitch McConnell. On Monday, McConnell was asked about the lack of legislative process in Congress this year, and he remarked that President Trump had, quote, excessive expectations for how fast legislation could move through Congress. That seemed to set Trump off, and Trump has spent the week attacking McConnell for failing to move his agenda. Trump even floated the idea that McConnell should step down as leader if he doesn't get health care, tax reform, and infrastructure bills done. Trump allies are also backing a primary challenger to Arizona Senator Jeff Flake, a Republican who's been strongly critical of the president. Trump seems to be starting a strategy of defining himself in opposition to Republicans in Congress. So what does that mean for Trump's movement, and what does it mean for the Republican Party? To discuss that, we're joined by a new guest, John Carney, who is the finance editor at Breitbart News. Now, John, first, last time you were here with us, you were at The Wall Street Journal, you've worked at CNBC, at Business Insider. What made you sort of decide to go to the other side of the wall?
Two things. I thought that the most interesting place to cover the Trump administration would be at Breitbart. They had done a lot of the most interesting work leading up to the election of Donald Trump. And I thought, all right, these are the guys who actually seem to see what's coming very well. I want to, you know, be a part of that and be able to do and learn to do what they were able to do during the election. The second thing was I miss startups, Josh. You know, you were at Business Insider. You know the energy that was there. Wall Street Journal, CNBC, great places. And I've learned a lot working with those people, but I miss the energy of the startup. And believe me, Breitbart's got startup energy.
So when you look at this sort of emerging feud within the Republican Party from the, you know, the populist perspective, the pro-Trump side of the conservative media, what do you make when you look at this fight that he's having with Mitch McConnell? When Trump says drain the swamp, is McConnell the swamp?
Mm-hmm. There's really three dimensions to it. The first is there's a lot of hard feelings among Republicans about the failure to repeal and replace Obamacare. And so there's a lot of finger pointing going on. You know, it's your fault. It's your fault. There's people with not just in the White House, but on Capitol Hill who think that McConnell did a bad job of communicating with his members. I mean, clearly he couldn't, you know, didn't bring John McCain along. But even before John McCain voted, you know, cast his famous vote, he was complaining about the way the process was being run. And so I think that is key to what's going on. It's, you know, nobody wants to take the blame for the loss. It's a little bit like the manager fighting with the coach. I think that the second thing that's going on is that Trump has a very different way than McConnell does of having disputes. Josh, you and I sometimes have debates over Twitter about things. Now, I could call you and we could set, you know, we could discuss, skills tests for immigration just in person. But we, you know, we kind of like having these debates out in public. I think Donald Trump enjoys having these kind of fights in public. He doesn't want to call McConnell up and say, hey, you know, you really bungled this thing. It's not satisfying to him. He is, you know, a Twitter president. And the finally other layer, I think that what's really going on here is a fight. This is all reflective of just a deeper division within the Republican Party. The Republican Party thought it was going to be one kind of party. They wrote a whole autopsy after Romney lost, and it was a plan for how they were going to become the majority party and win elections. Donald Trump threw that script out and won. I think that division between the way they see their own party is going to pop up in many of these little fights as we go forward.
But so when you say that Trump threw that script out, one thing that he did that was so different was that he ran in a lot of ways to the left of where Republican candidates usually run on the economy. He said he would protect Medicaid. He promised insurance for everyone. So if now the thing he's so upset about is that they didn't send him a health care bill that was basically a Paul Ryanist vision of health care, and he hasn't been able to sign that, would that really be putting his stamp on the party? Why does he even want this bill that Congress can't seem to figure out how to send him?
I don't think he wanted this bill in particular, to be honest. I think he wanted a bill that would fulfill his promise. I agree with you that the American people, on economics in particular, and I would include healthcare in that, are far to the left of where the Republican Party is. They have moved left over recent years. Donald Trump was elected in part because of this, and this is going to cause problems between them going forward forever.
Rich, as you watch this fight develop between establishment Republicans and the president, I mean, National Review was very skeptical of Trump for a long time, I think has taken a sort of mixed line on him since the election, been critical of a lot of things that he's done. If the direction that Trump has taken the Republican Party is not what you wanted, are you on Mitch McConnell's side here? Is Mitch McConnell in the right in this dispute?
Well, I think the failure of healthcare, both the amateur Trump in the White House didn't help, and in some respects was counterproductive. He couldn't do negotiations because he didn't know what was in the bill. He kind of advertised in these private meetings his ignorance of all the details to members of Congress and senators, so that wasn't helpful. But the professionals didn't cover themselves in glory either. Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell both were in a desperate rush. You know, that rush wasn't caused by Trump. They themselves were in a desperate rush to pass this, in part because they had a cognizance that what they were doing wasn't popular, and with every day that passed, it was going to get harder. So they came up with this screwy, secretive process based on serially springing new bills on people and saying we have to pass them in 5 days. And that was just no way to run a railroad. I do think Trump has a lot of running room here with the Republican base. If Trump continues to stumble, the base will blame first the media. You know, that's always the go-to. Then they'll blame the Capitol Hill leadership, and we're seeing some of that now. Then they'll blame Trump's staff, And the very last person they'll blame is President Trump. And I'm not surprised that we see some of this tension out in public now, because I thought if things didn't go well this year, there would potentially be the split between Trump and congressional leadership. What I thought would cement it, though, and prevent a total breach, is that Trump may very well, it's not impossible to conceive, that he may need Mitch McConnell to lead his defense in a Senate impeachment trial in 2019. And that's just one of the reasons that this guy needs every friend he can get, especially on his own side. So I'd imagine this will be a Sessions-like dynamic, a week or two of statements and tweets, and then finally Trump will give up and move on to some other target.
I like Rich's long view. That's that's an enticing long view. I was just going to say what John said I think is important, that this country has moved to the left on healthcare in important ways in these last year or so, longer. The town hall meetings played a role where citizens came out and engaged and pushed back and spoke of healthcare as a right, not just a privilege. I think this tees up a fight within the Democratic Party. You see it already between those who are driving Medicare for all and those who want to step back and be more cautious as 2018 approaches. But it's an opening for a new frame for healthcare. I did see, however, that I think three Freedom Caucus members put out another repeal bill today. So that will stay in play. So it's murky, but it is trending left on healthcare.
I want to turn to one more topic before we go. The Google memo, you've likely heard about the controversy over this memo by software engineer James Damore, who criticized diversity programs aimed at recruiting and developing women in technical jobs at Google. His argument was based on claims that there are aggregate population level differences between men and women in their average aptitude for and interest in technical jobs, that this is the primary driver of lopsided gender ratios, and that therefore specific programs to recruit and develop women and other underrepresented groups are counterproductive, he said. Katrina, what did you make of this controversy?
I moaned when I read that Damore had lost his job, as much as he probably deserved it, because there are a few things the right loves more than basking in its own sense of victimization, especially when it can claim the mantle of free speech while doing so. And I think that he's now going to become a kind of reactionary culture hero, and that's not good for the rest of us. I mean, I think he postured as a brave truth teller passing around sexism like Samizdat, and men like these draw power from being censored.
Rich, when I read the memo, what I found is, you know, there was a lot of outrage about these sort of psychological claims at the beginning of the memo, but I thought the memo was very poorly argued through. Basically, you know, even if you establish that there are some of these population level differences, he sort of assumes that that explains the entirety of the 80-20 gender ratio in Google's technical groups and says, well, you know, just because there are some differences between men and women, then there are no problems that need to be addressed with these sorts of diversity programs and they become counterproductive. And I've thought it's a little bit weird that conservatives are making such a cause celebre of him, because when you read the memo, I don't think it's as good a document as they think it is, even if you accept the premises at the beginning of it.
Well, what prompted the most outrage, though, is what was most unassailable about the memo, which is its account of these population level differences between men and women. And it's not anti-women or pro-man to highlight these sort of differences. And they don't mean that any one woman is not going to be better at programming than any given man. But it shouldn't be that relating things that are written all the time in social science literature is a firing offense. Now, I think you can argue whether he's right about Google's diversity programs. It doesn't seem they've had a lot of actual success, but you can argue that they're worthy anyway. But none of this should have been a firing offense. And he said Google has this culture of groupthink where people are afraid to say things like this because they'll get fired. And then he got fired for it. And it's Google's right to fire whomever they like. But please don't pretend that you have a culture of openness and free expression when you obviously have the opposite.
Juliette Kayyem, what did you think about this?
There's a lot of debate amongst women about our own roles in society. I'm, you know, sort of middle-aged at this stage, sort of, you know, how hard is it for us? Are we better off than our mothers, but not as well off as our daughters? Are we leaning in enough, in the words of Sheryl Sandberg? And I thought that the memo was just a stark reminder, and one that we have to remind ourselves every day, of the deep sexism that still exist in this country and in the workforce. The idea that women are not achieving because of some genetic or biological decisions that we're making to raise our children or family may or may not be true for some percentage of the woman. But it, in some ways, I found it kind of liberating because it reminded me that this, you know, they reminded me that there's still a fight. And every once in a while, I think that's a good thing to be reminded of.
John Carney, it seems to me that the viewpoint that he was expressing here and the sense that of being sort of a disenfranchised minority as conservatives within technology companies, this perspective is sort of laughed at, but it's laughed at in a way that it was laughed at in politics a few years ago. And people expressing like this things like this in politics became a very powerful movement within the conservative movement and then within all of American politics, sort of blindsiding everyone. So I'm wondering what this bears for the future in the business sector and the way that we've seen in the political sector.
There's a lot of people who feel that a variety of reasons, but very public incidents like this, that they are sort of monitored, under control. People like to talk about the alt-right. There's another phrase that I heard that's cute called the control left. And they feel like they are being controlled and restrained from dissenting from certain left-wing orthodoxies. I don't think that Google's resistance to what Damore was saying and their failure to actually be a more diverse company are unrelated. I covered Wall Street for years and years, and Wall Street has tried very much to change its own internal culture on the realization that if they want to become a diverse place, they can't expect more diverse employee base to act just like the white men who were there before, and that the workplace conditions that made those guys comfortable might not make the more diverse employees comfortable. One way of reading Damore's memo is to say that is what he is saying, but without the idea that, you know, maybe what we need to do is change more rather than less. And then instead, they fired him for just asserting that people might be different. I think that's a sort of very engineering approach, both on his part and on Google's part, rather than a more humanistic approach that would have said, maybe there are average differences between people. And if we want to be a diverse place, we have to change as well and not just expect that everybody will fit the model that we have set up already.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
I want to rant about leaks. No, not those leaks, but honest-to-goodness leaks involving water. I've recently taken responsibility of the management of an old house that had some plumbing problems that have brought home to me just how destructive even a little wayward water can be, and created on my part an even more profound respect and gratitude for people who are much better at stopping leaks than Jeff Sessions, namely plumbers.
Katrina Vandenhoevel, what's your rant?
I was moved to look at a sea of thousands of women the day after Trump's inauguration, but I was worried. I mean, women marching, extraordinary, but would they run? And now, for many reasons, Trump's election has inspired a stunning wave of female newcomers to electoral politics. Since November, an astonishing 16,000 women have contacted Emily's List, which works to elect pro-choice Democratic women, to say they want to run in the next cycle. And I think this is thrilling. I think Virginia is at the heart of it. And if Dems win Virginia and there's 17 seats, they've come to be known as the Hillary 17, where Clinton defeated Trump last November, may foreshadow the ability to break the GOP's grip on state power, not just in Virginia, but across the country. So women marching, women running.
Juliette Kayyem, what's on your mind?
This last weekend in Minnesota, there was an IED device that went off near morning prayers at an Islamic center, a well-known Islamic center there. The governor of the state believes it was a terror incident, and certainly the fact that it was a Muslim center would suggest that someone was targeting the religion. The White House has said nothing except for statements by a well-known national security advisor to the president, Seb Gorka, who suggested with no evidence that this might have been a false flag operation or something done by liberals to get attention. I don't know who did the device, but what I do know is that a place of faith for a religion that has been under attack in this country, or someone tried to bomb it with people very nearby. And the silence of the president says multitudes about both his capacity for compassion, and I honestly believe his humanity to lead this nation.
John Carney, what are you thinking about?
I've been growing increasingly irate at gullible stories that I read from my fellow journalists about labor shortages in farming and in home building. They say that this is going to cause crop shortages and that not enough homes are being built. If employers are choosing to reduce supply rather than raise wages, this is classic monopsony behavior. It implies that we don't have an effective competitive market in these places. If we have a competitive market, wages should be going up if there are labor shortages. If they are not, and instead businesses are reducing the supply of the goods they produce, this should be investigated by the Justice Department because it implies illegal monopsony behavior. Raise wages or quit whining about a labor supply.
For my rant, West Virginia Governor Jim Justice, who became a Democrat to run for governor in 2015, became a Republican recently, much to the delight of Donald Trump, since Justice announced it at a rally with Donald Trump. And now Justice has come back to ask for his payback. He is proposing a federal subsidy of $15 per ton for coal that is used for power generation. But not just any coal, only coal that's mined in the eastern United States. Coal mines that are more economically productive out in Wyoming, they wouldn't be eligible for the subsidy. But if you were mining, say, in West Virginia, you'd be able to get the subsidy. Now, when Republicans make arguments in favor of coal, there is usually a tip of the hat to the idea of cost. They complain that subsidies and regulations on the energy sector are causing people to move away from coal to more expensive options. But if coal is only financially viable with a federal subsidy, then there is no cost argument for switching back to coal, only a political argument to thank West Virginia for its strong support of Donald Trump. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Katrina Vandenhoevel, Juliette Kayem, John Carney, Tom Nichols, and Evelyn Farkas. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins is our production assistant. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I am Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.